Thanks, Angie. Me too. We'll see what comes out. I guess I want to start with a story, one that I pretty vividly remember. From many years ago, it was before I had children, before Brittany and I were married, before I was connected to Mennonites. I was attending a church gathering at a previous church, and it was a nice spring day like this. We were doing something outside. You have to appreciate that this church was kind of on a bit of a hill. To get kind of up to the top of the hill, there were these big concrete steps that went from the top down to the sidewalk. And what sticks out to me about this particular day is that there was a family with two parents and two young kids that I knew pretty well. They were kind of standing at the top of this stairway. Very pleasant family. Everybody knew them and loved them. Very kind, sweet people. But on this particular day, the children, or at least the youngest child, the girl who was about 3 or 4 years old, was just upset. Now, I was too far away to be able to overhear like what they might have been talking about or to really understand the context, but I could kind of see from her countenance, from her body language, that she wasn't particularly happy. And so she's up there stewing, and her older sister, who is about 5 or 6 kind of steps away, stands on the stairs just to like think for a minute, and she comes up behind her and shoves her as hard as she can, as if she's gonna push her down the stairs. And I remember gasping. It was horrific to see. Now, fortunately, the older sister caught herself, so she didn't go flying down the stairs. And this was followed by a predictable, like, Mom, Dad, and, you know, they were kind of telling, and the parents were trying to figure out what was going on and whatnot. But I just remember being shocked at, like, the willingness of this sweet young girl to just plummet her sister down a set of concrete steps. And I don't say this to shame this girl. I mean, I've kept in some touch with them since then, and she seems to be a perfectly fine, normal, sweet human being. I don't think there's anything particularly dysfunctional about this family. It's not like they were modeling this violent behavior. It just seems to be that this reveals something in human nature. That there is something, even at that kind of a young age, that is kind of violent, that can rise up inside of us. And I just remember being baffled at how clearly I could see it at that moment with this young child, and wondering, like, where does this come from? And that's what these stories in Genesis are seeking to do. They're kind of making sense of this part of human nature. So last week I started a new series on Genesis that kind of looks at it through a type of family systems lens. And it starts in Genesis chapter 2 by depicting what God had created in Eden as kind of an ideal family system. You might recall that I talked about how each member, Adam and Eve, they're created separately. They have purpose. It's not just to be with each other, but to till the garden and to keep it. In terms of their relationship with each other, they were equals. Eve comes from Adam's rib. She's his partner. Neither is superior or subordinate to the other. And of course, it makes this comment that they were naked and not ashamed. And I made the case that the kind of nakedness it was discussing wasn't just physical, but was emotional and spiritual. It was kind of an ability to just be yourself, to put it out there without a fear of being judged or manipulated, taken advantage of, because there is this deep knowledge that you would be accepted and you would be safe. But then, unfortunately, in Genesis chapter 3, the serpent shows up. And when this happens, the family begins to break down. It starts with distrust entering the system. The serpent sows these thoughts in Adam and Eve's mind that, you know, maybe God doesn't have your best interests in mind. Maybe all of these rules and regulations are just so that God can manipulate you. And they eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They become exposed to all of the ways in which they could be harmed or mistreated. And their instinct then is to cover up. They literally cover themselves with fig leaves and figuratively cover themselves and their mistakes by speaking about the ways in which the other person caused them to do wrong, by trying to hide from God. And soon after that, we see this blame, this finger pointing, it emerges, and all of a sudden, even this ideal family system had been corrupted. It was no longer the kind of safe place where acceptance prevailed. So Adam and Eve had to leave Eden. That's not actually the end of their story. It's sad. It's tragic, even. But God did not give up on Adam and Eve afterwards. We find, for example, that God is still taking care of them. It says that the Lord God made garments of skin for the man and his wife and clothed. That's particularly interesting because God's desire for Adam and Eve was that they could be so comfortable and so safe that they wouldn't need clothing. But they messed up. They chose to eat from the tree of knowledge and evil, of good and evil, against God's commandment. But God accommodates them. God gives them much better garments than the fig leaves that they had put together for themselves. And after they leave Eden, they continue building a life together. They have children. They have two sons who are mentioned here, Cain and Abel. And later we read about a third son, Seth. And not only did they continue to have children, but they continued to have a relationship with God. And we hear this in the way that Eve speaks in her final words in the book of Genesis. The last thing that Eve says, which interestingly doesn't get nearly as much attention from theologians as her conversation with the serpent in chapter 3, is that she says, "I have produced a man with the help of the Lord." That means that she and they were continuing to relate to God in some way, even after they were out of the Garden of Eden. Life was harder, labor was harder, but the relationship with God continued. And this is what their children, the next generation of human beings, Abel and Cain, inherited. So what was this next generation like? Well, they seem to have been clothed. From here on out in the story, I think we can assume that everybody is wearing clothes, which generally I consider to be a good thing now. I generally recommend people wear clothes, but I think it does indicate something, that there is a fundamental insecurity built into humanity now. You can't be as secure in yourself and how you will be treated as you could have in God's original design. Everybody can still relate to one another, but there are these barriers that we put up, arguably that we have to put up now in the context of a fallen world. They continued to care for the earth. We hear that Abel was a shepherd, and Cain was a farmer. But you might remember from the curses in chapter 3 that it was a little harder to do this now. And as I just mentioned with Adam and Eve, they continued to relate to God, but this was a little more complicated too, and it seems that they had come up with a kind of offering system, that they would make offerings, some of the fruit of what they produced, or from the animals that they herded. They offered it to God as kind of a way of establishing, continuing that relationship. Unfortunately, it was in the context of that offering that we see the next big step into dysfunction emerge. And so I want to take another moment to look into the details of that story, especially picking up in verse 3. It says, "In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, for his part, brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard." That last line is the gut punch. That for Cain and his offerings, God did not have regard. God was not pleased with what Cain was giving. Makes you wonder, well, why not? Well, the text isn't really explicit about it. Now, there have been people who have been studying this text for thousands upon thousands of years. Some of the oldest Jewish scholars observed that when Abel brought his offerings, he brought kind of the firstlings, the first fruit, the best of his flock. Whereas when it describes Cain's material, it just says that he brought an offering of fruit. So maybe it wasn't the best. Maybe Cain was kind of shirking and not giving it his all in the same way that Abel was. It's a good theory. We just don't know for sure what the reasons were. Unfortunately, Cain never asks. But we do know one thing that it is not. It was not because God just liked Abel better, that Abel was going to get this kind of preferential treatment. And we know that because God says it. God sees the way that Cain is starting to react and process this and says in the response, "If you do well, will you not be accepted?" He knew that Cain's insecurity was beginning to act up, that the shame that humans could feel was all of a sudden starting to spread. But God wanted to say, look, it's not that I won't accept you. I just need you to do this a little better. Unfortunately, Cain couldn't quite hear that advice. Instead, Cain's response when God does not look favorably upon his offering is that Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. Now, the second part of this sentence, the claim that his countenance fell, that makes sense to me. I mean, he's disappointed. He's discouraged. I would certainly feel that way if I had offered something to God and God did not look favorably upon it. I mean, that hurts. But the part that's a little more curious is that Cain was very angry, that he turned to anger in this moment. And it wasn't anger at God. It wasn't that God, you made these standards too high, and that's not fair because I can't live up to them. Nor was it anger at his parents because they had failed to teach him properly how you're supposed to make these offerings to the Lord. Nor was it even anger at himself, at least that he could acknowledge. His anger was directed at his brother, Abel. And that was bizarre, because Abel had done absolutely absolutely nothing wrong to him. He had done absolutely nothing to hurt his brother. He was a shepherd. He kind of had his work, his career. Cain was a farmer. As far as we know, they were kind to each other. They got along okay. Abel wasn't trying to show off or wasn't trying to mock Cain. He was just doing what he was supposed to do. He made an offering out of the sheep, the flocks that he had made. He offered it to God, and God was pleased with it. But for some reason, that made Cain furious. So furious that he wanted to kill his brother, who had done nothing wrong to him. Why? Well, this is the first instance we see in the Bible of something that is going to become a major thread from here on. Envy. Cain began to experience envy. This deep sense of frustration and unfairness and even hatred towards his brother because he perceived that his brother was better than him. Envy seems to come out of this kind of comparing thing that we do to other human beings. And we do it all the time. In fact, an article I was reading in preparation for this from Psychology Today suggested that some people think that as much as 10% of human thought involves comparing ourselves to some other human being at one level or another. Even though it doesn't always make sense, even though there's not always a competition or a standard at play, God wasn't comparing Abel and Cain. God didn't say to Cain, "Cain, you really didn't do what your brother did. You need to follow his example." Just said, "Cain, if you do well, you will be accepted." But we bring this kind of comparison in with other people. And when that happens, once we start comparing others, that becomes the way that we assess our own value. It's how we tell ourselves, in the state of insecurity that we've inherited, whether we are good or not. And we find, then, that we have a need to either be equal to or surpass the people around us. That's how we cope with this deep kind of insecurity, this lack of acceptance, by needing to be equal to or superior to others. And so this manifests itself as envy. And psychologists sometimes distinguish between two types of envy. They'll talk about good envy, and that is an envy that when we see somebody else and they seem to be better than us in some way, we think to ourselves, man, that's inspiring. I should try to be like that. If they can do it, then I can do it. Something along those lines. I have to say, I am really suspicious of the term good envy. I appreciate the way that the book of Ecclesiastes talks about it, where it notes that, where the author says, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from one person's envy of another." All toil and all skill and work might be a bit of an overstatement. We remember that there was work, and it was good in the Garden of Eden, even before sin and envy had entered the picture. But it's certainly the case that in our society, in the way that specifically our capitalistic economy works, that envy is a driving factor, that envy drives people to buy products, that envy drives companies to compete against one another, that companies use envy to pit employees against one another. And that, sure, this can often cause people to achieve, but is what they end up achieving out of a desire to just be a little bit higher than the people around them ultimately something that's good? Or is it just a vanity and a chasing after the wind. Something that we often don't recognize until we've been doing it for quite some time. But anyway, so psychologists talk about how, yes, in the state of insecurity, when we're seeing other people, we think they're better, there's often this good envy. But then there's also something that they'll call bad envy. And that is that if I see another person and I don't believe that I can elevate myself to their level, that I can match them, then in order to make myself feel better, I want to bring them down. I want to expose them or weaken them or hurt them or shame them so that I don't have to live in the reality where there's another person out there in my face who's better than me, making me feel bad about myself. Once this envy enters the biblical story, it becomes a major theme. We see it in the lives of Sarah and Hagar when Sarah forces this poor slave woman to sleep with her husband. And once she becomes pregnant and is about to bear his child, she becomes envious and acts abusive, casts her out even. We see it with Jacob and Esau, in which Jacob becomes envious of the treatment that his brother is getting. And as a result, he's willing to trick and manipulate and cause a wedge to emerge in his family. We see it in the story of Joseph and his brothers, when they are envious of the way in which he seems to be treated like the cream of the crop, and so they sell him into slavery. You see, as time goes on, the ways in which humans express their envy becomes more varied, more sophisticated. We don't just shove somebody down the stairs or try to kill them as soon as the feeling arises within us, but it can still plague us just as much. In our lives, we already talked about the way that envy is cultivated in our society, how good envy is often cultivated by performance standards in competitions. It's pervasive, it's everywhere. But this bad envy is something that I would argue that all of us have experienced too. Maybe we don't experience it first and foremost as a kind of desire to murder somebody, but it manifests in us whenever we start thinking about somebody and we are just filled with a sense of annoyance. Like as soon as we see them, as soon as they enter a room, we find ourselves feeling annoyed, even if they haven't done anything to us, or to be triggered by someone. There are some people in our lives who, oh man, it doesn't take much for them to say something or do something for us to rush to that place of just being so mad at them. The kind of gossip, the toxic way in which we talk about people is often characterized by envy and hatred. The hatred that plagues our society. We often can't see what's going on behind that hatred. Why it is that our thoughts are so consumed with somebody or a group of people who deeply bother us. But we wonder, I wonder if in most cases, ultimately it's a kind of misplaced anger, that we feel insecure about ourselves, about the way that we live in the world, and we see other people and we see things that they have that we don't have, or things that they get away with that we don't get away with, and it's easier to fixate on them and channel our negative emotions on them than to be able to look into ourselves and say, why does this bother me so much? Why really has my countenance fallen? And am I feeling so down? Well, fortunately, the story, even for Cain, doesn't end there. Yes, Cain murders his brother. It's terrible. As a result, he is pushed even further away from God's presence, further from Eden, further east. But God does not give up on Cain. God puts a protective mark around him. And God allows Cain to build a family and to have a life of his own, so that his whole life isn't characterized by this one act or mistake either, as awful as it was. But we also find that in this moment before Cain commits this act, God was trying to intervene because he knew how hard it would be. And so God says to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Ultimately, it is going to take more than just this kind of warning to be able to overcome the forces of envy. Ultimately, Christ is going to have to come into the story and bring an even more powerful force of forgiveness and love. But I still hope that God will continue speaking to us in this way. I still hope that even as I go through my day and my life, if I find myself feeling frustrated, if I find my thoughts getting fixated on someone and I can't shake it out and I'm just feeling overcome with annoyance or frustration, that I can hear the voice of God saying, Brian, why are you angry? Don't you know that you can be accepted? Don't let these walls of envy and hatred cover up from the insecurity you feel. Don't look to others to deal with that. Look to me. May we all be able to hear God's voice in those moments of